good morning, good morning. It is the end of the week, a getaway Friday morning, November the 3rd, first Friday in November 2017, 12 minutes after the hour. Scott Spears along with you here on the Now program. Do want to give you a reminder. I almost forgot this myself, but this Saturday night, Sunday morning, however you want to refer to it, at 2 o'clock in the morning, we fall back. We go back on daylight savings time. So fall back. You gain an extra hour's sleep on Sunday, early Sunday morning, late Saturday night. So you probably want to set your clock back Saturday night so you don't miss whatever you do on Sunday morning. So that's this weekend. But joining us this hour is one of my favorite people, a multiple-time guest to this program. I watched her for many years on the McLaughlin Group and followed her work in Newsweek. Still follow her on the Daily Beast, where she resides now. And when it comes to politics, there is nobody better to talk to who knows what's going on in Washington. And we've said it time after time after time, but since the new administration came in, there has not been a boring minute. But as far as that goes, this past week might have been the most eventful, with some people getting indicted, and who knows where that will go. Joining us, one of my favorite people, Eleanor Clift. Eleanor, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. Monday, not a good day for the Trump presidency. Is that safe to say?
I think the first two indictments that came down... Is my voice breaking up?
Yeah.
I think there's another phone off the hook. Let me go do that.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Talk among yourselves.
We will do that. And remember, folks, you're listening to WWGH Radio, 107.1 FM. You can get us anywhere in the world, WWGH1071.com. Also, check out the Facebook page, WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. And remember the TuneIn app. You can download the free TuneIn app on any mobile device and search WWGH, and you can hear us all over the world. And don't forget, archived programs since January of 2016 on the website, and live election coverage. The live election coverage Tuesday night, 7:10 p.m. here on this station. Eleanor, Monday, difficult day for Trump, President Trump.
Well, I think when the first two indictments were reported, Paul Manafort and Rick Gates, I think that the president thought, well, this is mostly their private financial shenanigans and doesn't necessarily have anything to do with him, the campaign. And then the surprise indictment was George Papadopoulos, who nobody had really ever heard of, and a very lengthy charging document which reveals that he has been cooperating with the Mueller team since July, and that he talks specifically of contacts between campaign officials and people in Russia. And that, I think, really tied the Trump campaign to the allegations of Russian collusion. Now, whether that's criminal is another question. That has yet to be sorted out. But the Papadopoulos name was a new one for everyone, and I think that probably told the president, or signaled the president, that the Mueller investigation was quite far-ranging.
Now, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Eleanor, is that this Papadopoulos was approached in January of this year. He said something that wasn't true. They brought him back in July. He took a plea agreement, started to work with the Mueller investigation, possibly even wearing a wire, people have speculated, and was in, or at least in contact, with the Trump White House from July through just the end of October, possibly giving information to the Mueller investigation. Do I have that right about Papadopoulos?
Yes, yes. And the White House, with Sarah Huckabee Sanders basically saying He was a low-level volunteer. We hardly knew him. And then all the reporters backfilled and pointed out that the candidate, Trump, said that he was a member of his foreign policy and national security advisory team. He cited his name in an interview, I think, with the Washington Post. And then a picture surfaced with Papadopoulos sitting with then-Senator Sessions, then-candidate Trump, and an array of other officials around a table. So he's not a stranger, and I think a number of people must be going back and thinking, what did they say to him, not only during that period, but in these most recent months, if indeed he was wearing a wire and was actively trying to solicit information for the Trump team. So you've already got aides in the White House. Everybody's got a lawyer. And you know, people are nervous. They don't know where this is going. And I think President Trump has been pretty restrained considering his penchant for always lashing out. And then, of course, he's gotten a gift in this revelation from former chair of the DNC, Donna Brazile, talking about how the DNC basically rigged the election for Hillary Clinton. And so Trump is like equating collusion on the Democratic side to game the nomination for Hillary Clinton, saying that's much worse than anything alleged on his side, and that there's no collusion with Russia on his side. So he's got an argument that he's going to make, and that people who support him are going to believe.
I do want to, in the I guess, case of being fairness, get to the Donna Brazile thing here in a second. But, okay, Papadopoulos lied to federal investigators in January. That's a felony. But he came in and took a plea deal. Now, what is the plea deal? Is he okay now?
I only know what I've read, and it suggests that he will not get any jail time. And if he gets a financial penalty, it would be rather modest compared to what he would otherwise receive. Yeah, no, he basically gets off in exchange for being cooperative. And the charges against Manafort and Gates are 12 charges, I guess, each. And they're very stiff, and they can't leave their homes, and they're basically their flight risks. And so Mueller has asked for protections to make sure they don't leave the country. And so the speculation then goes to the charges against Manafort and Gates are so tough that they could be angling for a pardon from the president. So there's talk about whether it would make sense for him to pardon people to avoid any of these cases coming to trial and perhaps exposing information that he might not want out. Or the charges are so stiff that Manafort and Gates might be tempted to cooperate, just like Papadopoulos did, in order to get more lenient handling by the court. So that's everything that's kind of stirring around in the atmosphere here in Washington. And so the president is off to Asia, but that's not going to stop him from having to react to the ongoing probe.
Now, the Papadopoulos thing, there are two more things about this I want to cover, just for people who may not be following it as closely as you and I. In July, he took the plea agreement, whatever that was. He agreed to start working with the Mueller team. Now, we do not know that he did wear a wire or if anything was picked up. But what common sense would tell me is, if he was working for them, and nobody had a clue who Papadopoulos was really until Monday, why would the investigators bring him up on Monday? Because theoretically, they could have let him do more work undercover, which that kind of blew that cover on Monday when they announced his name. And then you have to look at that time period from July until the end of October when he was undercover. Besides wearing a wire, what good would it have done to leave him undercover or even give him a plea agreement? Anything in those two questions?
You know, you have to get into Mueller's head there and what kind of a chess game he's playing. Again, there's been so much speculation from lawyers and others that what I glean from it is that if they had just left the indictments with Manafort and Gates, everybody was expecting Manafort, and the fact that his assistant or his deputy also got nailed wouldn't have been this big surprise. And again, Trump could have said, it's not entirely true, but he could have said these are financial crimes going way back before the campaign, has nothing to do with me. And I think that was the argument that the White House was prepared to make. And so by tossing in the Papadopoulos indictment, you're letting Trump know that you have a lot more information about a lot more people, and that Mueller may be prepared to cross that red line that Trump tried to invoke in an interview several weeks ago, that members of his family would not be involved. So I think the inclusion of the Papadopoulos indictment gave Monday the shock and awe that Mueller intended. Now, in terms of him getting further use from Papadopoulos and that he's giving him up prematurely, maybe he's got other people in that same category, people we hardly know who got sucked up in this thing and who, in exchange for, it's not exactly immunity, but in exchange for a plea deal where they would not be severely damaged in terms of jail time or financial penalty, that they're willing to talk. There could be more Papadopouloses out there. And I heard somebody say that there were four sealed documents at the court. Now, I have not independently confirmed that, but I think that the likelihood is going to be many more people named in this thing before it comes to a conclusion.
I hate to go far out in the weeds on speculation, but what this Papadopoulos thing did for me on Monday, the first thing was what you just said. There probably are more Papadopouloses, because why would you give him up if not? And number two, we have long speculated about the vice president, because obviously if Trump does get in trouble for this and he does have to resign or leave, you get Pence. And there has been, you know, in the Nixon era, Agnew went first, but that was a whole other thing. But in this particular instance, Pence was very active at the Republican convention, which I was at, and he headed the transition team when Christie left, which included Flynn, who I'm thinking an indictment has to be coming for him. So
right.
If there is a Papadopoulos who possibly could have had a wire, or there are more Papadopouloses, I think this puts the vice president, who also has a lawyer, in graver danger than maybe we would have thought.
Right. Pence is this kind of silent partner with the very sycophantic around the president. kinder, gentler, always got the smile and almost the pastoral delivery when he speaks. But if you start digging into how he got to be Paul Mort, was his benefactor. And in the article in The New Yorker by Jane Mayer on Pence a couple of issues ago, she points out that the choice came down to between Pence and Governor Christie, and that Trump actually preferred Christie, and it was Paul Manafort and then also the son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who favored Pence. And I think they argued that Pence's religiosity and his conservative views on social issues would be a better fit for the Republican Party. And of course, Governor Christie had many problems at home. So they went with Pence, but Manafort was the go-between there. And you point out that Pence was very active in the convention. Well, Manafort was the person who corralled all the delegates and made the non-Trump and the never-Trump delegates, kept them corralled. I mean, he played a very important role at the convention. And he also worked to change the platform on Ukraine. Now, Pence, I'm sure, was aware of all that. It was in the newspapers. And Pence went along with that. So I don't, you know, what does Manafort know about Pence? What does Pence know about Manafort? So that's a connection that could be explored some more, and maybe Papadopoulos plays a role there as well.
And I think Bannon has left, Priebus has left. So whether they're in the clear or not, who knows, but they're no longer working there. So aside from Pence, we're really down to Trump and his family and Pence. And I'm guessing that Pence probably goes under the bus before his family, although I am hearing that Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, is not in high favor with the president right now.
Well, yeah, there's a Vanity Fair article out which has Trump complaining that Jared made some choices that started this whole Russian collusion mess in the first place. And even months ago, I think stories surfaced that it would be better for Jared Kushner to go back to New York and instead of staying here. And I think that's even before the worst of these news articles about collusion surfaced. I mean, Jared's family and his family's corporation, and they've got real financial problems with a property in New York. And so there are financial threads to follow with him. And that's one thing we learned on Monday, is how thorough Mueller is with putting together all the forensic evidence on the financial trails. It's follow the money taken to the nth degree. And I'm sure if you start following the Jared Kushner money, and Kushner was the one during the campaign who was heading up the big data program. I mean, he was the one who was in touch with Cambridge Analytics, and you know, that's the company that's been tied to WikiLeaks and the Russia, I guess, fake advertising or fake news stories. So I think that's another set of links that are going to be made. And Jared Kushner is one of the people who could potentially be indicted.
I look at Jerry Ford in a time like this because his answer to the pardon of Richard Nixon, because we're definitely talking about pardons now, was fascinating. Because everybody said, well, he pardoned him because there was a deal. Alexander Haig delivered the deal. Ford would get it if he pardoned Nixon. And Gerald Ford's answer, I thought was fascinating. He said the offer of a pardon is just an offer. The acceptance of a pardon is the admission of guilt. That Nixon did not have to accept the pardon. If he believed that he was innocent, he could have argued that. So, I look at President Trump, and if he would pardon Manafort or Gates or anybody else who comes in this line, possibly Kushner, possibly Flynn, possibly even his own son, Don Jr., if he pardons them, is that an admission of guilt?
You know, to you and I, it probably, to you and me, it probably would be. To the people who support Trump, it would be giving the middle finger to a justice system that's going crazy, I think. He would probably react to it in the same way a lot of Democrats reacted to the impeachment of Bill Clinton, that it was a partisan thing. And you know, with every pardon, you do have some people who probably were, I mean, broadly speaking, presidential pardons. You probably have some people who may be innocent of the crimes that they're now being excused of. But if you're offered a pardon, who would not take it? That's the thing.
It's interesting because now we're talking about taxes. That's the big thing. Because now, with all the financial, as you said, accuracy and digging that Mueller is doing, there's probably not much of a chance that he doesn't have Trump's tax return, is there?
I can't believe that he doesn't. I mean, and there were stories, I think a couple of months ago, that they were working with an arm of the IRS that, you know, looks into corruption. So I can't imagine that he does not have the tax returns. I've always felt they were the Rosetta Stone, frankly, because, I mean, Trump has gone to great lengths to make sure that they don't see the light of day.
And in theory, a lot of people are now saying that if they can't pin collusion on President Trump, that the tax returns could possibly reveal that he's done something wrong there, a financial crime, I guess I should say.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, if he's filing tax returns and he's committed a financial crime, he's always under audit. In a way, you would think that that would have been brought to light. There, maybe you could get him on lying to the FBI. Lying to the American people, there's no punishment for that, except maybe at the ballot box. But lying to the FBI or lying to the special counsel, that would be serious. But yeah, I don't really know what those tax returns can reveal or document. I imagine they will show money from Russian banks or oligarchs, to the extent that you have to reveal that in a tax return. You know, this is way above my pay grade, these financial dealings. I'm in the Manafort indictments, you have them using the Bank of Cyprus, and a number of people are suggesting that the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, apparently is, I don't know whether he's on the board of the bank. There's some connection that he has with the Bank of Cyprus. So, you know, that might prove to be an interesting revelation. But, you know, where did Trump get his information? And, you know, Trump financial dealings, they may uncover laundering of money there. I mean, when they went into Manafort's house at that early morning raid, people kind of wondered, why did you have to do that? Well, apparently they carted away many years of past tax returns, and they were able to put together this case on money laundering, exactly where the money came from. Now, you would think the IRS would have those documents, too. I don't know, but they they carted away a lot of documents from his house. And they went in at that early morning time with a surprise raid because they didn't want to give him a chance to destroy that. They also went through his closet, and there was some people saying, was it really necessary to pour through all his expensive Italian-made suits? Well, we now learn that he paid for all that with wire transfers from the Bank of Cyprus. And the money, the staggering amount, I guess it's $75 million between the two of them, and they laundered a portion of that. But then he's so petty. You know, he's using this money from ill-gotten money that he doesn't pay taxes on, you know, to pay his groundskeeper in the Hamptons. And, you know, that's amazing to me.
Is there any chance that President Trump was just naive or in the other room when all this was going on? He didn't know that Manafort and Gates and Flynn and maybe Kushner and Papadopoulos and all these people, Roger Stone, were not on the level?
Well, he's known Roger Stone for decades. Roger Stone has been something of a political mentor to him, and if anybody wants to know more about Roger Stone, there's a terrific documentary called Get Me Roger Stone, which explains this kind of almost comical, dirty trickster going back to when he was a teenager, first hooking up with Richard Nixon. So Donald Trump certainly knows what Roger Stone is about. Manafort, I think when he hired him, and of course, Manafort didn't take any money from the campaign, but when he brought him aboard as the campaign manager to corral the delegates and make the convention come off, he was hiring someone he knew to be a political pro. Manafort had done that for Gerry Ford. He'd done it for Ronald Reagan. He'd done it for Bob Dole. So I'm sure Trump didn't vet his background at all. So to that extent, he would be clean on that. But the machinations with Russia, he had to know something was going on because he said very loudly and proudly, you know, Russia, if you can find those 30,000 Hillary Clinton emails, you know, let's see them. I'm sure you'll be treated favorably by our press. So I think he had some idea that there was some back and forth. He probably was not involved in the back and forth, but I don't think he can claim complete innocence. Now, I don't think he took it seriously as a potential federal crime or potential treason or anything like that. I mean, if you listen to him the last few days, he's spouting off about the guy from Uzbekistan who did this horrific act in New York. He's saying, oh, he should get the death penalty. I'll send him to Guantanamo. I'll do this and that. He's prejudicing the case, and he's making it harder to get justice under our system. And then he makes fun of our system. We have a joke system here. Well, actually, we've done very well in prosecuting people accused of terrorism. So, and he says he wishes he could do more controlling the investigations from the Department of Justice. It's frustrating that he can't control them. He has no idea what the values that our country is founded on and how he is just bulldozing all of those things in the name of just popping off his immediate frustration. So, yeah, so I think I don't think he probably thought that he was dealing with something that could potentially bring down his administration if he did win the race. But he certainly, I think, knew something was afoot.
Now, something interesting this week in Silicon Valley. Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg. During the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing Wednesday, the Silicon Valley company said 146 million people saw Russian posts on Facebook and Instagram, far more than previously disclosed. Facebook disclosed in September of last year that more than 3,000 ads were bought by 47 fake accounts and pages run by the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg. Those accounts have been shut down. Some of those ads were released Wednesday showing Russian operatives had targeted users on subjects including gun rights, gay rights, religion, and presidential candidates Trump and Clinton. Cyber world, 63% of the people get their news from Facebook. Well, what do we say about that?
Well, the lawyers for Facebook, Twitter, and Google, I think, were on the Hill testifying this week. And the fact that these companies sent their lawyers as opposed to sending the CEOs did not sit well with the members of the Senate. And I looked at them and I'm thinking, my goodness, they're now in the great tradition of the tobacco executives testifying on Capitol Hill and the auto executives. Suddenly they're not the good guys with the halos that we thought they were. I think they're coming to terms with their role in this, and Congress and the American people are just beginning to understand how this worked and the incredible sway that Russia's propaganda machine had in this country, and it was basically to help elect the candidate they wanted, or more directly, to defeat the candidate they really didn't want. I think the animus against Hillary Clinton was greater than support for Trump. Now, I think as voters and as citizens of this republic, we bear some blame too if we're getting all our news from Facebook. Some people get all their news from Facebook. Everybody gets some of it, and they are setting the agenda. And we people, not necessarily someone like me or you who pays close attention and probably gets multiple newspapers and all that, but people just living their ordinary lives, depending on being kept up to date through Facebook, are getting a somewhat distorted picture of our politics. And Congress is now thinking, is there a role for regulation? Now, the tech companies don't want regulation. They don't even want to acknowledge that they're not just tech companies, they're now media companies. So they're claiming that they're going to do more self-policing, but it's you bump up against the First Amendment, and the First Amendment allows pretty much everything except you can't call fire, can't cry fire in a crowded theater. So how do you determine when some of this stuff goes up, when it's shouting fire in a theater? And what happened in New York just bolsters our concern about this, because that young man, basically, when he came here, he wasn't radical. He was radicalized in this country watching, videos on his phone. And so the ability of ISIS and terrorist networks to radicalize people using social media is a major problem. People don't have to travel to Syria and the battlefields there to learn how to be a terrorist. They just tune into Facebook. So we're just coming to grips with this as a society. I think it's a huge problem, because you don't want to regulate the internet or censor the internet, but you can't allow this sort of freedom of expression that undermines our national security.
I want to spend our last 10 minutes talking about Hillary Clinton and Donna Brazile because President Trump has tweeted about that this morning, and we'll bring people up to date on that in just a second. But after Monday, I realized how far Mueller's investigation has gone and already gone. And with Papadopoulos, I'm starting to believe that maybe there's a little more than meets the eye. And I guess that leads me to this question. It would seem to me that at some point, somebody's going to have to go here because somebody knows something, Mueller or Trump. Do you think Trump would dare fire him? Do you think that Mueller will lead to the end of Trump?
I think the people that Trump have brought into the White House, notably Ty Cobb, who was an accomplished white-collar crime lawyer, they're saying he has no intention at this time of firing a Mueller. I think it would spark, people say, constitutional crisis or whatever. I mean, I think it would really... It would really make it look like Trump has something serious to hide. So I think for now he's not going to do that. And as for Mueller leading to the end of Trump, Mueller is building a case, and in the end, he's not going to indict the president. I think that's highly unlikely, and then maybe unconstitutional. But he will build a case, and he will present it to the House, and no president has ever been impeached when his party controlled the House. Now, there haven't been many impeachments, but there's a reason why that's true. I think today, if the case were made to the Republican House, they would not vote to impeach Trump. They want to get their tax cut, and they're scared about 2018. And right now, they've decided that it's better to hang together, or else they would hang separately. So that might change if there's a smoking gun and Mueller comes up with it. That could change. But given today, I think Mueller stays, and I think Trump stays.
And we move on to Hillary Clinton. The president this morning tweeted, "Everybody is asking why the Justice Department and FBI isn't looking into all of the dishonesty going on with crooked Hillary and the Dems." New Donna B., which is Donna Brazile, book says she paid for and stole the Democratic primary. That was a Trump. Now, Donna Brazile was a former CNN correspondent for many years. That's probably where you remember her. She was the head of the Democratic Party at one point during this, or the last election cycle. And she's publishing a book. Why is Donna Brazile doing this? And could we see lock her up chance again?
It's. I think I said as we started out this hour that this is a real gift to Trump. I don't doubt the truth of the book. I do think the Democratic primaries were. I don't want to use the word rigged, but the Dem National Committee looked at their candidates and they assumed that Hillary Clinton was a very strong candidate, and they looked at Bernie Sanders, an over 70 years old socialist, and they thought that he had no chance to win and that he could only just make trouble. And I think it was a surprise to a lot of people, including maybe even to Bernie Sanders, how popular he got and how there was a genuine fight going on within the Democratic Party between Clinton and Bernie. And that would all be fine. And I think Clinton would have won legitimately, but the DNC did put their thumb on the scale in favor of Clinton. The initial primaries were, not primaries, the initial debates were scheduled at times where they almost didn't want anybody to see them. And the Bernie people complained about not getting the assistance from the DNC that the Clinton people were getting. And so this is not a new line of attack. What Donna brings to it is that she has actually written agreements which gave the Clinton people more dominance over the party than they should have had until they actually secured the nomination. And, you know, there's blame to go around here because President Obama kind of neglected the party, too. And under his watch, I think 1,000 legislative seats were lost. The House and Senate was lost. Governors were lost. So he was not exactly a big party builder. And so coming out with this book at this time, I think Donna assails Obama and Clinton, and she unfortunately, I think, gives Trump ammunition for his crooked Hillary charge.
What I don't understand, because again, correct me if I'm wrong in this chronology, Debbie Wasserman Schultz was the head of the Democratic Party when this primary season started. So she would have had the hand in scheduling the debates and things of that nature. At some point, the emails are leaked out that she is doing bad things. Now, during this time, Donna Brazile is employed by CNN as an analyst. During this time, we didn't know it at the time, but apparently she had slipped Hillary Clinton some questions to a CNN debate while Wasserman Schultz is running the party. Then we find out Wasserman Schultz is tilting toward Hillary. She has to resign, and they appoint Donna Brazile. But we don't know that she slipped her the questions yet. She leaves CNN. She becomes the chairperson for the party. And then we find out later on that she had slipped Hillary Clinton questions. And now she's writing a book saying, we tilted things toward Hillary. But didn't she tilt things toward Hillary by giving her questions?
But that, I think that was after Hillary had won the nomination, wasn't it, in the debates against Trump? But I do think that your overall critique does suggest there's a little bit of, you know, self-serving reading of history here on the part of Donna. But she was in a position to know. And she has documents, and basically she's revealing what everybody was charging at the time, and that was that the party anticipated Hillary Clinton would be the nominee. They did everything to kind of clear the field and stack the deck for her, because history tells us if you have a contentious primary, it weakens the nominee. They viewed Bernie Sanders as an irritant, you know, not somebody who was bringing valuable issues to the table that they should have dealt with. It was a misreading of how the race was going to unfold. But they, coming to terms with much energy that Sanders tapped into the party versus the apathy about Hillary Clinton. Now it looks pretty obvious, but at the time, I think people didn't realize that, and I think the DNC kind of thought they were just carrying out their function. But the Bernie people have a legitimate beef as to how that was all carried out, and in retrospect, a fair fight between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, I think she would have won anyway, but the fact that they had to give her this help along the way delegitimizes her primary victory, and I think that's what's going to be the reaction to Donna's revelations and this book. And it's at a time when the main narrative for Democrats going forward into an election year should be the delegitimization of Donald Trump. We shouldn't, be looking at the primary between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and I think that's from if you're on the Democratic side, this story comes at a time that's not helpful to Democrats. But I think it's all too true, and Donna Brazile had every reason to go ahead and publish it.
Just for the irony of things, and because I didn't remember either, I just Googled it. Debbie Wasserman Schultz resigned on July 24th, which would have been when Donna Brazile
was the first day of the convention.
First day, right around there, yeah.
Right.
And which meant Donna Brazile would have taken over shortly thereafter, mm-hmm. which so she would have slipped her the question during the primary debate against Bernie Sanders because she was already.
Really?
I think so.
I thought it was against Trump.
I think so, because she would have already left CNN to be the chairwoman.
Yeah. Well, that kind of undermines. Well, she's revealing a problem that she was part of then.
Yeah, it's irony, isn't it?
Right. Yes, it certainly is.
Do you think it's? I understand she has the right to write the book, but do you think it's money here? See, she's not employed anymore. Because of some of the things she's done?
Yeah, she has a consulting practice. I really don't want to. I've known Donna a long time. She was actually Al Gore's campaign manager in 1980. When did he run? Was it 88? No, in 2000. She was Al Gore's campaign manager in 2000. And she had to step aside because she said some things that were not kind about Colin Powell. And there was a huge backlash. And so I don't think they stripped her of the title, but she basically kind of had to step aside. And she's a squeaky wheel, and mostly for good causes, but maybe not always from everybody's perspective. This is a squeaky wheel that doesn't help the Democratic Party. But you know, I'm not. You know, how many loyalists are there to the parties? Either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. I mean, both parties. Their brands are not that great.
Just to be factual, the date, we didn't find out till October 11th, but Brazile sent the question on March 12th, so it would have been a primary debate.
Okay, interesting.
So she was right. Irony, I guess.
Totally. But in today's world, you make one mistake, and with Trump, you make another bigger mistake, and you cover up the earlier mistake.
and
here you make a mistake, and then you make a splash with something else, I guess.
Eleanor,
that's how the game works.
I have two quick questions for you, Eleanor, before we wrap up. First of all, what don't we know is coming? Something has to be going on with all this Mueller investigation. And with the uranium and what's going on with Hillary and Donald Trump being president, do you think she'll be investigated? Do you think she did something possibly criminal?
They've already launched another investigation of Uranium One, which is a uranium company based in Toronto that the Russians bought a stake in, and that was okayed by seven different agencies when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. She had nothing to do with it. It's been investigated numerous times, and they come up with nothing, but they need a new Benghazi, so I think that's what it is. So yeah, there'll be more investigation. I don't believe it'll come to anything.
And what's coming down the path? What's something that's not hit the wire yet?
Oh gosh, it's too difficult to keep up with everything that's already here. I think Trump stacking the federal courts is a big issue because the Republicans kept open a lot of seats, the Supreme Court seat being the most notorious, but many on circuit courts and so forth. And now Trump is rushing through to fill all of these judges, and McConnell is having them vote on multiple judges, which is unusual, and they only need 50 votes to get through all of these judges who've been vetted by the Federalist Social Crisis Network. They're pretty far to the right. And you do get the feeling that that the Republicans want to get as many of their judges in place as long as they've got a hold on this presidency and the two houses of Congress, because they're not sure how long that's going to last.
Eleanor Clift of the Daily Beast, make sure you check her out. Eleanor, it is always, what a fun conversation this morning. Thank you.
Right, okay.
Have a great week, and don't forget to fall back on
Sunday. I will. Thank
Take
you.
Care. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
We're going to take a break and be back right after this.
To talk. Streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com. Find